For Connecticut Public Radio, I'm John Henry Smith. As we now know, a jury found former police officer Derek Chauvin guilty on all counts in the killing of George Floyd. As the world now awaits Chauvin's sentence, we are also awaiting the ways in which this drama will, or won't, change policing. To weigh in with his thoughts, I welcome to the program John DiCarlo. He's the director of the master's program in criminal justice at the University of New Haven. He is now a full-on professor. Congratulations on that. And he is also the former police chief in Brantford. John, your thoughts as a longtime wearer of the badge on the trial and the conviction of Derek Chauvin?
I think what we're going to see is a spike in murder convictions and in convictions on police officers in general. We saw that after Ferguson, and we then saw that level off. But to give that some proportion, really, you know, there are about 70,000 cops in the United States. They have about 60 million contacts with the public every year, and about 1.8% of those contacts result in any kind of force. And you know, when we look at what's going to change and what might come about as a result of this particular case, the Chauvin case, what we have to look at are the ultimate results and what we want to accomplish. You know, and obviously, police are there as members of the community to serve that community, to provide order, and to protect public well-being. And they have to do that in a way that is acceptable to the population, to those communities. And when it isn't, and of course, police are very much in the public consciousness right now, what we see are some very very stringent calls for change. So how will we change them? You know, it's not enough, quite frankly, to convict cops after we have a victim. I would submit to you that it would be a much smarter thing, but more difficult, honestly, to change the way we select police officers, we train police officers, we educate them and recertify them so that things like this don't happen.
Of course, the Derek Chauvin killing of George Floyd was not done with a gun, but so many of the fatal police interactions with the public are done with guns. What can be done about about so many police officers getting into situations where they feel the need to use that gun and wind up killing a member of the public?
When we look at the number of police shootings in the UK last year, there were three. And when we look at the number of police shootings in Australia last year, there were zero. And that's because both of those places don't allow guns. And we are a country that has guns. We have a Second Amendment. Guns are part of our popular consciousness. They are in our films. They are in our literature. And they are freely available. Not only do the police have guns, but the population has guns. So as long as there are guns, there are going to be shootings. And I'm not trying to be an apologist for bad policing, but when guns here or shootings are the issue, and we have to keep in mind that there are also 12,000 gun-related homicides a year in the general public, and we can't forget those, and we can't lose sight of the fact that the bigger issue here are the fact that there are guns available. And secondly, how do we have less shootings? How do we use officers and train them so that they don't go to the gun initially or as quickly? Is that possible? You know, with the whole population being armed. You know, even when we look at the Washington Post database of about 1,000 people being shot by police officers a year, the vast majority of those people are armed. And so what do we do? And I personally find it hard to believe that it's 2021 through science, we just basically defeated a pandemic. A worldwide pandemic, and we did it with this really cool technology that had never been used before. But yet, we are still giving our police officers technology that, you know, from 1700, you know, we're giving them guns. You know, is there not a better way through the use of technology to be able to subdue someone who is about to do some nefarious deed or threaten someone else? And I think that we have to get together as a country and decide whether we want this to go on.
We hear so much about police needing better training, but, you know, earlier this week, body cam footage of another police shooting of a black man, I think this one was in the New York or New Jersey area, I can't remember which one, revealed the officer told someone that no one was hurt, just the perp, as if the perp isn't someone. Can policing really change when it seems there are a great many officers out there that don't seem to see the people they police as human beings?
We can't train police officers like we do soldiers, because soldiers have enemies and police officers have communities. And that is a big distinction. And if we train police officers like we train the military and we enculturate them like we do the military, then we should expect them to act like they have enemies. And quite frankly, criminals are not enemies of the police, and the community is certainly not the enemy of the police. You know, there are people with criminals are very often people with drug problems, with drinking problems, with psychological problems, emotional problems, and we can't always depend on them to act rationally when they're dealing with the police. So we have to train police officers, augment their police officers with technology and with other professions like social workers, psychologists, and other things. You know, and we're looking, it's scary because when I hear that we want to defund police, I think that we should make police better and we should spend some money on that front end of training police and educating police and augmenting them with better technology to prevent and better training to prevent any deaths.
It's been hinted at in the wake of the George Floyd killing that there are too many different standards depending on what locality, what city, what town you're in with regards to policing. Do you ever see a time, or is it a time right now, to federalize policing in this country?
We're in a downturn now as far as crime. Crime has been going down in the United States since 1994, and there's kind of an axiom in criminal justice that when crime goes down, we are very interested in due process. The general population is very interested in due process, but when crime goes up, the general public starts clamoring for crime control and more aggressive policing. So it's a good time, since crime is going down, to kind of get these policies through now. And do we need credentialing for police chiefs? Do we need a national office of policing? You know, will we ever federalize policing in the United States? No, maybe not. We're a federalized democracy. We're not going to be like Britain or, you know, some other common law countries. But that doesn't mean that we can't have some kind of federal oversight outside of a consent decree to guide best policy in policing. I mean, if we looked at during the Obama administration, we came out with a wonderful document that was called the 21st Century Policing Task Force. And it kind of was a blueprint to engage the public and police to improve the lot of the way we police our communities.
You know, it was striking in this trial to see police department members testifying against Derek Chauvin. Do you think this was just a Chauvin-specific occurrence? Do you think it could be evidence, on the other hand, of cracks in the infamous blue wall of silence?
I think that when I read the statement from the Connecticut Police Chiefs Association en masse yesterday, when the verdict was released, and that was that police take an oath to protect and serve their communities, and Derek Chauvin didn't do either of those things. It made me realize that police themselves are beginning to get the message, and I see so many cringeworthy moments in policing. You know, there are 700,000 police officers in the United States. And when, for instance, Officer Potter shot Mr. Wright earlier in the week, she thought that she had grabbed her taser and had her service weapon out. So many people said, "Oh, but I'm so happy that wasn't me." And you know, the mistakes that we know could be made, and the kind of technologies that we use, and the potential for problems are all wrapped up. And every police officer, every good police officer in the United States, looks at this stuff happening, and they wonder what's going on. The individual police officers and even individual police departments don't have the wherewithal to make change in a system that obviously needs change. Collectively, we have to be anarchist right now in when it comes to policing, and we have to change a system that needs change.
There's one perfect storm element leading to the death of George Floyd that I have not heard discussed anywhere. The compact size of the back seat of a police car. When I was living in New Jersey, the Edgewater police were out there at a town fair with a couple of cars greeting the public, and an officer allowed me and my daughter to sit in the back of the car. I wanted her to see what it was like so she could see that's a place she never wanted to be. But my daughter and I were both struck by how claustrophobic that space was. You felt like if the car was in an accident, you were a goner. You couldn't get out, and it was just right up on top of you. And it was that tightness that freaked out George Floyd. I mean, if you remember, he had been compliant up until then. Why do police car backseats have to be so claustrophobic?
This is a great question. You know, it's made that way to limit the movement of the person that's in there. And again, very often when we have someone in a police car, they are in an emotionally unstable state. They could be in all kinds of trouble, physically or emotionally. And what they're looking for in that kind of situation is putting someone in a place where they can't move easily. It limits people kicking out the back windows, et cetera. And it's not a pleasant place to be. So how do we make change in that regard? And you're absolutely right. It's made just like a jail cell, not to be a pleasant place to be. But the fact is that a jail cell happens after an adjudication, after someone is found guilty and could be construed in some way as a punitive measure. But should the back of a police car be punitive and claustrophobic? That's something that we have to get together and ask ourselves and find out from police officers and people who are doing the job what the benefits of having a back seat like that is, as opposed to having a safe, more roomy back seat and a better way to transport people who have been arrested.
60 Minutes this Sunday had the Oath Keepers on, a white supremacist group, of course, here in America. And one of the Oath Keepers proclaimed that his group had police officers throughout its ranks. And you've heard similar stories from a variety of groups that there are more than a few white supremacists in policing, not only in policing, but also in the military as well, which I know is not your purview. But What can be done about that? I know that the new Secretary of Defense has vowed to wring that out of the military. Do you see a similar desire in policing to wring white supremacy out of policing?
White supremacy should not be in policing or any thinking that doesn't involve equity shouldn't be in policing in any way. I doubt the ability of policing in the United States to effectively weed that out, because they are administered by about 18,000 different municipalities. The standards of entry are different. The selection process is different. The retention is different. I don't think that, quite honestly, that we have enough of a national level control over who becomes a police officer, who remains a police officer, and how we train police officers to make that promise to the general public. And it's a promise that we certainly must make.
John DiCarlo with the University of New Haven, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you so much, John.